south hope went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloudy draw.
This is Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona with Western Short Stories. Today, we feature three stories by Alfred Henry Lewis, the late 19th century author whose tales we have read in the past. These are from the book Wolfville Days, published in 1897 by Frederick A. Stokes and Company of New York City. Lewis uses dialect extensively, and I will attempt to read the dialogue as the author intended. In addition, our stories are edited slightly for recording. We start with Johnny Florer's Axle Grease. It was the afternoon, cool and beautiful. I'd been nursing my indolence with a cigar and one of the large armchairs which the veranda of the great hotel afforded. Now and then I considered within myself as to the whereabouts of my old cattleman when I heard him making vocal melody. "You're a singer," I observe. "I'm melodious natural, but I'm getting so I sort of stumbles in my notes. Shouting and singing round a passel of cattle to keep them from stampeding on bad nights, that's spiled my voice that-a-way. There's nothing so weakening vocal as them efforts in the open air in the midst of the storms and the elements. What for a song is that I'm rendering? Son, I learns that ballad long ago, back when I'm a boy in old Tennessee. It's writ, word and music, by little Molly Hines, who lives with her pop, old Homer Hines, over on the Possum Trot. Molly Hines is sure a poet, and has a mighty sight of fame local. She's what y'all might call a Joe darter of a poet, Molly is, and let anything touchin' or romantic happen anywhere along the Possum Trot, so as to give her a subject, and Molly would be down on it, instanter, like a fallen star. She surely is a verse-maker, and is known in the Cumberland country as the Nightingale of Big Bone Lick. I remembers when a Shylock over to the Dudleytown Bank forecloses a mortgage on old Homer Hines and offers his settlements at public vandue that-a-way. I remembers how Molly prances out and pours a poem into the miscreant. There's 111 verses into it, and each one like a bullet out in a Winchester. It goes like this. "Thar's a word to be muttered to the rich man in his pride, which a gent is frequent richest when it's jest before he died. There's a word to be uttered to the hog a-eatin' truck, which a hog is frequent fattest when it's just before he's stuck." Mighty spirited epic, that. You recalls that English preacher sharp that comes squandering around the tavern year for his health about a month ago? Sure. I knows you couldn't overlook no bet like that divine. Well, that night in them parlors, when he reads some rhymes in a book, whatever it is that PC reads, Locksley Hall, right you be, son. As I was saying, when he's through rendering said Locksley Hall, he comes butting into a talk with me where I'm camped in a corner all cozy as a toad under a cabbage leaf, recovering myself with liquor from them recitals of his, and he says to me, this parson party does, "Which, it's surely a setback, America has no poets," says he. "It's evident," I says, "that you never hears a Molly Hines." "No, never once," he replies. "Is this year Miss Hines a poet?" "Is Molly Hines a poet?" I repeats, for my scorn at the mere idea kind of stiffens its knees and takes it bucking some. "Molly Hines could make that Locksley Hall gent you was reading from, or even the party who writes Watts hymns, go to the disc yard." And then I repeat some 40 of them stanzas, whereof that one I just now recites is a specimen. "What does this pulpit gent say?" "He see I has him cinched, and he's plumb mute. He confines himself to turning up his nose in disgust like Bill Story does when his father-in-law horsewhips him." Following this, the old cattleman and I wrapped ourselves in thoughtful smoke, for the space of 5 minutes, as one who pondered the genius of the Nightingale of Big Bone Lick, Molly Hines, on the banks of the Possum Trot. At last my friend broke forth with a question. "Whoever is them far-off folks y'all was telling me is related to Injuns?" "The Japanese," I replied. "Undoubtedly the Indians and the Japanese are of the same stock." "Which I'm fooled like a mule," said the old gentleman. "A complete prey to inborn notions agin Injuns. I wouldn't have one pestering around me, more'n I'd eat off the same plate with a snake. I sure has aversions to 'em a whole lot. Of course, I never sees them Japanese fellers, but I savvies Injuns from feathers to moccasins, and comparin' those Japan folks to Injuns, I feel about 'em like old Bill Rollins says about his brother Jim's wife." "And how was that?" I asked. The afternoon was lazy and good, and I'm in a mood to listen to my rambling gray comrade talk of anybody or anything. "It's this-a-way," he began. "This year Bill and Jim Rollins is brothers and abides in Roanoke, Virginia. They splits up in their youth, and Jim goes plantin' out to the west, which he sure guts there, and nothing's heard from him for 40 years. Bill Rollins, back in Roanoke, waxes a heap rich, and at last clears up his game and resolves like takes a rest. Also, he concludes to travel, and as long as he's going to travel, he allows he'll sort of go projecting round and see if he can locate Jim. He gets a musty old tip about Jim, this Bill Rollins does, and it works out all right. Bill cuts Jim's trail way out yonder on the slope at a metropolis called Los Angeles. But this year, Jim, ain't that there none. The folks tells Bill they reckons Jim is over to Virginny City. It's a month later, and Bill is romancing along on one of them Nevada mountain meadow trails when he happens upon a low, squatty dugout, the same being a camp rather than a house, and belongs with a hay ranch. In the door is standing a most ornery seaman gent, with long tangled hair and beard, and his clothes looks like he's surely witnessed times. The hands of this hairy gent is in his pockets, and he exhibits a mighty supercilious air. Bill pulls up his cayuse for a powwow. "How far is it to a place where I can camp down for the night?" asked Bill. "It's about 20 miles to the next wiki up," says the supercilious gent. "Which I can't make it none tonight, then," says Bill. "Not on that hoss," says the supercilious gent, for Bill's pony that-a-way is plenty played. "Maybe then," says Bill, "I'd better bunk in yer." "You can gamble y'all don't sleep yer," says the supercilious gent. "None whatever." "And why not?" asked Bill. "Because I won't let you," says the supercilious gent, biting off a piece of tobacco. "This here's my camp, and foreseeable invasions by casual hold-ups like you don't prevail with me a little bit. I resents the intrusion on my privacy." "But I'll have to sleep on these yer plains," says Bill, a heap plaintive. "Thar's better sparts than you all slept on them plains," says the supercilious gent. Meanwhile, there's a move or two, especially the way he bats his eyes about this supercilious gent, that sets Bill to rummaging around in his memory. At last he asks, "Is your name Rollins?" "Yes, sir, my name's Rollins," says the supercilious gent. "Jim Rollins of Roanoke?" "Jim Rollins of Roanoke." And the supercilious gent reaches inside the door of the dugout, searches forth a rifle, and pumps a cartridge into the barrel. "Stand your hand, Jim," says Bill, at the same time sliding to the ground with the hoss between him and his relative. "Don't you get impetuous. I'm your brother Bill." "What?" says the supercilious gent, abandoning them hostile measures, and joy settling over his face. "What?" he says. "You my brother Bill? Well, don't that beat Grizzly Bar's amazin'. Come in, Bill, rest your hat. Which it's simply the tenderness of hell I don't miss you." Whereupon Bill and Jim tracks along inside and goes to canvassin' up and down as ensues durin' them 40 years they've been parted. Jim wants to know all about Roanoke and how things stacks up in old Virginny, and he's chuckin' in his questions plenty rapid. While Bill's replyin', His eye is caught by a frightful-looking female who goes slying in and out, organizing some kind of grub. She's the color of a saddle, and Bill can't make out whether she's a white, a Mexican, or an Injun. And she's that hideous, this female is, she comes mighty near giving Bill heart failure. Son, y'all can't have no idea how terrible this person looks. She's so ugly the flies won't light on her. Yes, sir, ugly enough to bring sickness into a family. Bill can feel all sorts of horrors stampeding about in his frame as he gazes on her. Her eyes look like two bullet holes in a board, and the rest of her features is tetatatiously indescribable. Bill's intellects at the awful sight of this year person almost loses their formation, as Army gents would say. At last Bill gets in a question on his rapid-fire relative, who's shooting him up with queries touching Roanoke to beat a royal flush. Jim, says Bill, sort of scared-like, whoever is this year lady who's roaming about the scene? Well, there now, says Jim, like he's plumb disgusted. I hope my gun may hang fire, if I don't forget to introduce you, Bill. That's my wife. Then Jim goes surging off all spraddled about the numerous and manifest excellencies of this female, and holds forth alarming of and concerning her virtues and loveliness of face and form, and all to such a scandalous degree, Bill has to step outdoors to blush. And Bill, goes on Jim, and he's plumb rapturous now that way. May I never hold three of a kind again if she ain't got a sister who's as much like her as two poker chips. I'm courting both of them mighty near 4 years, for I can make up my mind whichever of them I needs. They're both so absolutely similar for beauty, and both that alluring to the heart, I simply can't tell how to set my stack down. At last, after 4 years, up and cuts the cards for it, and wins out this one. Well, Jim, says Bill, who's been sitting there shuddering through them rhapsodies, and now and then getting a glimpse of this year female with the tail of his eye. Well, Jim, far be it from me, and me your brother, to go avouching views to make you feel dubious of your choice. But candor's got the drop on me, and compels me to speak my thoughts. I never sees this sister of your wife, Jim, but just the same, I'd a heap sight rather have her. And as I observes previous, concluded the old gentleman, I feels about Japs and Injuns like Bill does about Jim's wife that time. I never sees no Japs, but I'd a mighty sight rather have 'em. There was another pause after this, and cigars were produced. For a time, the smoke curled in silence. Then my friend again took up discussion. There comes few Injuns investigating into Wolfville, doring them Emutes of Cochise and Geronimo and Nana. The Apaches goes nothing and south closed in by that camp of yours, but you bet. They're never that locoed as to rope once at Wolfville. We all would surely have admired to entertain them hostiles, but as I suggest, they're a heap too enlightened to give us a chance. The Injuns never finds much encouragement to come haunting around Wolfville. About the first visit, an Injun meets with a contretemps, though this is inadvertent a heap and not designed. This buck, a Navajo, I takes it, from his feathers, has been pirooting about for a day or two. At last I reckons he allows he'll elope off into the foothills again. As carrying out them rude plans which he forms, he starts to scramble onto the Tucson stage just as old Monty's collecting up his range. But it don't go. Injuns is barred. The guard, who's perched up in front next to old Monty, pokes this year feller in the middle of his face with the muzzle of his rifle, and as the Injun goes tumbling, the stage starts, and both wheels passes over him the longest way. That Injun gives a groan like 20 sinners, and his lamp is out. Old Monty sets the brake and climbs down and sizes up the remainder. Then he gets back on the box, picks up his 6 hosses, and is getting out. "Here you," says French, who's the Wells Fargo agent, a-callin' after old Monty. "Come back and either plant your game or pack it up with you. I'm too busy a gent to let you or any other blinded drunkard go leaving a funeral at my door. There's enough to do here as it is, and I don't want no dead Injuns on my hands. Don't put him up there and go spiling my mailbags, howls old Monty, as French and a hoss hustler from inside the corral lays hold of the Navajo to throw him up on the luggage. Then come down here and ride herd on the play yourself, you murdering sot, says French. And with that, he sure cuts loose and cusses old Monty frightful. Cusses till a cottonwood tree in front of the station sheds all its leaves, and he deadens the grass for 100 yards around. Promoting a sepulchre in this rock-ribbed landscape, says French, as Jack Moore comes up, kinda apologizing for his propane voilence at old Monty. Framing up a tomb, I say, in this year rock-ribbed landscape ain't no child's play. And I'm not allowing none for that homicide Monty to put no such tasks on me. He knows the Wolfville rule. Every gent skins his own polecats and plants his own prey. That's whatever, says Jack Moore, and unless old Monty is thirsting for trouble in elaborate forms, he acquiesces therein. With that, old Monty hitches the Navajo to the back of the wagon with a lariat, and then the stage, with the Indian going along behind, goes racking off to the north. Most likely, them antipathies of mine again Injuns is a heap enhanced by what our experiences back on the old Jones and Plummer Trail, when they was wont to stampede our herds as we goes driving through the Injun territory. Any little old dark night, one of them Injuns is liable to come skulking up on the windward side of the herd, flap a blanket, cut loose a yell, and the next second there's $120,000 worth of property scally-hooting off into the space on frenzied hoofs. Next day, these same untutored children of the woods and fields would demand 4 bits for every head they helps ground up and return to the bunch. It's a source of revenue, true, but plumb irritating. Them Indian fellers corral sometimes as much as $100 by such treacheries. And then we all has to rest over one day to win it back at poker. Will Injuns gamble? Sure, and to the limit at that. Of course, being as you savvies, benighted people that way, they're some easy, having no more judgment as the value of a hand than Steve Stevenson, and Steve would take a pair of nines and bet 'em higher than a cat's back. We allers recovers our dinero, but there's time and sleep we lose and don't get back. Yes, indeed, son. Injuns common is as ornery as soapweed. The only good all you can say of them is they're natural-born longhorns, is uncomplaining, and savvies the West like those old cowboys savvy liquor. One time, this year is way back in my Texas days, one time I'm camped for long over on the upper Hog Thief. It's rained a heap, and being as how I'm on low ground anyway, it gets that soft and swampy where I be it would bog a butterfly. For once I'm took sick, has a fever that way, and loose flesh. Surely you should have seen me. It falls off like persimmons after a frost, and gets as gaunt and thin as a cow in April. So I allows I'll make a layoff for a couple of months and recuperate some. Cossetan and pettin' of my health, as I states, I settles up and goes cavortin' over into the Osage Nation to visit an old compadre of mine, who's a trader thar by the name of Johnny Florer. This year Florer is an old-timer with the Osages. Been with 'em it's mighty likely 20 year at that time, and is with 'em yet for all the notice I ever receives. On the occasion of this embassy of mine, I's a chance to study them fellers and get a line on their characters a whole lot. This tune I'm with Johnny, what y'all might call Osage upper circles, is a heap torn by the untoward rivalries of a brace of eminent bucks who's each struggling to lead the fashion for the tribe and raise the other out. Them Osages, while blanket Injuns, is plumb opulent. There's 1,600 of 'em, and they has to themselves 1,500,000 acres of as good land as ever come slipping from the palm of the infinite. Also, the government is weak-minded enough to confer on every one of 'em, each buck drawing the dinero for his family, 140 big iron dollars annually. Wherefore, as I observes, Them Osages is plenty strong, financial. There were two high-rolling bucks I speaks of, who's struggling for the social supremacy, is in the midst of them strifes while I'm visiting Florer. It's some 2 moons prior when one of them, which we'll call him the Aster Engine, takes a heavy fall out of the opposition by going over to Cherryvale and buying a superannuated 2-seat Rockaway buggy. To this he hooks up a span of ponies, loads in his squaws, and P-raids around from Paw Husky to Gray Hoss, the same being a couple of Osage camps, and thereby reduces the enemy, what we'll name the Vanderbilt Engines, to desperation. The Aster Engines surely has the call with that Rockaway. But the Vanderbilt Osage is a heap hard to down. He takes one look at the Aster Engines Rockaway with all its blinding splendors, and then goes streaking it for Cherryvale, like a drunkard to a barbecue. And he sees the Rockaway and goes at several better. What do you all reckon now that engine equips himself with? He wins out a hearse. A good, big, black, roomy hearse, with plumes onto it and glass winders in the sides. As soon as ever, this Vanderbilt engine stiffens his hand with the hearse. He comes trooping back to camp with it, himself on the box driving, and putting on enough of lordly dog to make a pack of hounds, which he surely squelches the Asters. They just simply lay down and wept at such grandeur. Their Rockaway ain't 1, 2, 3, ain't in the money. And every day, the Vanderbilt engine would load his squaws and papooses inside the hearse, and there, wrapped in their blankets and squatting on the floor of the hearse for seats, they'd be looking out of the winders at common fellas who ain't in it and don't have no hearse. Meanwhiles, the Buck Vanderbilt is driving the outfit all over and round the cantonments. The entire bunch is sassy and as flippant as a coop of catbirds. It's all the Asters can do to keep from going plumb locoed. The Vanderbilts win. One morning, when Florer and me has just run our brands onto the fourth drink, an old buck comes trailing into the store. His blanket's pulled over his head, and he's panting and giving it out he's powerful ill. "How's my father?" says Johnny, in Osage. "Oh, my son," says the engine, placing one hand on his stomach, and almighty tender. "Your father gets up this morning, and his heart is very bad. You must give him medicine, or your father will die." Johnny passes the invalid a cinnamon stick, and exhorts him to chew on that, which he does prompt and satisfactory, like cattle on their cud. This cinnamon keeps him steady for most of 5 minutes. "Whatever is the matter with this feller?" I asks of Johnny. "Nothing particular," says Johnny. "Last night he comes pushing in here and buys a bottle of Worcestershire sauce, and then he gets gaudy and quaffs it all up on a theory that she's a newfangled kind of fire water. He gets away with the entire bottle. It's now he realizes them errors and takes to groaning and allowing it gives him a bad heart, which I should surely admit as much." "Your father is worse," says the Osage, as he comes cutting in on Johnny again. "Must have stronger medicine. That medicine," holding up some of the cinnamon, "that not bad enough." At this, Johnny passes his father over a double handful of black pepper before it's ground. "Let my father get away with that," says Johnny, "and he'll feel like a bird. It will make him gay and full of pison, like a rattlesnake in August." Out to the rear of Johnny's store is piled up under a shed more than 2,000 boxes of axle grease. It was sent into the nation, consigned to Johnny by some ill-advised sports in New York, who figures because the Osages as a tribe abounds in wagons, there must surely be a market for axle grease. That's where them New York persons misses the Ford a lot. Them engines has wagons, true, but they no more thinks of greasing them axles than painting the running gear. They never goes against that axle grease game for so much as a single box. Said ointment is a drug. When he don't dispose of it none, Johnny stores it out under a shed some 20 rods away and regards it as a total loss. "Axle grease," says Johnny, "makes a pint in civilization to which the engine has not clambered, and them optimists, Easts, who sends it on year, Should have never made no such a break. Maybe it's because this axle grease grows sullen and feels neglected that-a-way. Maybe it's the heats of two summers and the frosts of two winters that spiles its disposition. Sure it is, at any rate, that at the time I'm there, that unguent seems fretted to the core, and has given forth a protest and fragrance that has stood off a coyote and made him quit at a distance of 200 yards. You might even say it's caused nature herself to pause and catch her breath. It's when the Alan Osage, whose malady is too deep-seated to be reached by cinnamon or pimento, comes frontin' up for a third prescription, that the axle grease idea seizes Johnny. "Father," says Johnny, "come with me. Your son will now saw off some big medicine on you, a medicine meant for full-blown gents like you and me. Come, father, come with your son, and you shall be cured in half the time it takes to run a loop on a lariat." Johnny breaks open one of the axle grease boxes, arms the chief with a chip for a spoon, and exhorts him to cut in on it a whole lot. "Son, the odors of them wars is awful. Kansas butter is violets to it, but it never flutters that Osage." He takes Johnny's chip and goes to work, spading that axle grease into his mouth like he ain't got a minute to live. When he's got away with half the box, he tucks the balance under his blanket and retires to his teepee with a look of gratitude on his face. His heart has ceased to be bad, and them illnesses, which aforetime has him on the go, surrenders to the powers of this year new medicine like willows to the wind. With this, he goes capering out for his camp, idly humming a war song, such as his relief. And here's where Johnny gets action on that axle grease. It surely teaches also the excellence of them maxims, "Cast your bread upon the waters, and you'll be on velvet before many days." Within 2 hours, a couple of this sick buck squaws come sidling up to Johnny and desires axle grease. It's quoted at 4 bits a box, and the squaws changes in 5 pesos and beats a retreat, carrying away 10 boxes. Then the fame of this big new medicine spreads. That axle grease becomes plenty popular. Other bucks and squaws shows up, changes in their money, and is made happy with axle grease. They never has such a time, them Osages don't, since the Battle of the Hosshoe. Son, they packs it off in blankets, freights it away in wagons. They turns loose on a regular axle grease spree. In a week, every box is sold, and there's orders stacked up on Flora's desk for 2 car loads more, which is being hurried on from the east. Even the engine's agent gets wrought up about it, and begins to bellow and paw around by way of compliments to Johnny. He makes Johnny a speech. "Which I've made your excellent discovery, Mr. Floor," says this agent, "the basis of a report to the government at Washington. I sets forth the mad passion of these year Osages for axle grease as a condiment, a beverage, and a cure. I explains the tribal leanin' that exists for that special axle grease which is crowned with years, and owns a strength which comes only as the corollary of hard experience. Axle grease is like music, and soothes the savage breast. It is oil on the troubled waters of existence. Its feet is the feet of peace. At the touch of axle grease, the hostile abandons the warpath and surrenders himself. He washes off his paint, and becometh with axle grease as the lamb that bleedeth. The greatest possible uprising could be quelled with a consignment of axle grease. Mr. Floor, I congratulate you. From a humble storekeep, selling soap, heron and salt hoss, you takes your stand from now with the philanthropists and leaders among men. You have conjoined Indians and axle grease. For centuries, the engine has been a problem which has defied government. He will do so no more. Mr. Floor, you have solved it with axle grease." And that was Johnny Florer's axle grease. Now we'll read Toothpick Johnson's ostracism. "You see," observed the old cattleman, as he moved into the shade, "you see this year Toothpick disgraces Wolfville? That's how 'tis. Down's a party, Toothpick Johnson does. It all comes from Toothpick being by nature one of those year overzealous people, and prematurely prone that away. He's born eager, Toothpick is, and can't help it none. Toothpick is too quick. His intellects, it looks like, is on eternal tiptoe to get into a stack. He's too simultaneous, is Toothpick, says Jack Moore once, when him and Boggs is discoursing together, sizing up Toothpick. He's that simultaneous, he comes mighty near being a whole lot too adjacent. What does Toothpick do that time we all disapproves and stampedes him? It's a accidental killing. It's second drink time in the evening, and the Tucson stage is in. There's a passel of us who has roped up our mail, and now we're standing round in front of the red light, breaking into letters and papers and making comments, when along wanders a party who's been picnicking with the camp. As the deal turns, he never does stay long enough to become a genial acquaintance and a favorite of all. This party who comes sidling up is, as we hears, late from Red Dog, and during them 4 hours wherein he confers his society onto us, he stays drunk habitual, and never does lapse into being sober for a second. It's sure remarkable now how all them Red Dog people stays intoxicated while they sojourns in Wolfville. Never knows it to fail, and I allows, as solution that away, it's owing to the superior merits of our nose paint. It's a compliment they pays us. However, this Red Dog gent's drinking is his own affairs, and his earnestness about liquor may have been his system. Then again, it may not. I don't go prying none to determine. But being he's plumb drunk, as you readily discerns, it keeps up a barrier again growing intimate with this party, and until Toothpick opens on him, his intercourse with Wolfville is naturally only formal. This visitor from Red Dog, which Red Dog itself is about as low-flung a bunch of criminals as ever gets rounded up and called a camp, but this tottering wreck I mention comes straggling up, more or less promiscuous and vague, and, without saying a word or making a sign, or even shaking a bush, stands about lariat distance away and stares at Toothpick, blinking his eyes mighty malevolent. It ain't no time when this here bluff on the part of the drinking Red Dog gent attracts Toothpick, who's been skirmishing among us where we're standing, and is at that time mentioning Frater's stew as a good thing to eat to Dave Tuck. "Who y'all be admiring now?" says Toothpick of the Red Dog party, who's glaring towards him. It's then I notes the lights begin to dance in Toothpick's eyes, with that impulsive spirit of his. He's due to become abrupt with our visitor at the drop of a hat. That Red Dog gent don't make no retort, but stands there with his eyes picketed on Toothpick like he's found a victim. Toothpick is fidgeting on his feet, with his thumb stuck in his belt, which this last is a bad symptom, as it leaves a gent's artillery easily to reach. It strikes me at the time that it's even money there's going to be some shooting. I don't then, nor now, know why none, but that ignorance is common about shootings. 2 times in 3 nobody ever does know why. I reckons now it's Toothpick's fidgeting makes me suspicious he's on the brink of rousing the occasion with his six-shooter, which, if he's cool and calm, it would never come to me that-a-way. A cool gent never pulls the gun first, leastways never when the pretext is frivolous and don't come under the head of must. "Well," says Toothpick again, "whatever be y'all gloating over," I asks. "Or maybe you're thinking of adopting me as a son or something," says Toothpick. Still, the party from Red Dog don't say nothing. As Toothpick ceases, however, this Red Dog person makes a move, which is reasonable quick for his hip. He's got on a long coat, and, while no gent can see, there's none of us has doubts but he's fully dressed, and that he's searching out his colts. That's what Toothpick allows, and the Red Dog party's hand ain't traveled 2 inches under his surtout when Toothpick cuts free his 44, and the Red Dog party hits the ground, face down, like a card just dealt. He's dead enough. Never does kick or flutter once. It's surely a shot in the cross. "Do you all note how he tries to fill his hand on me?" asked Toothpick, mighty cheerful. Toothpick stoops down for the Red Dog man's gun, and what do you all think? He don't have no weapon. None whatever. Nothing more vigorous than a peaceful flask of whiskey, which the same is still safe in his rare pocket. "He warn't healed," says Toothpick, straightening up and looking at us, apologetic and disgusted. It's justice to Toothpick to say, I never yet overtakes that gent who's more abashed and discouraged than he is when he finds this person ain't packing no gun. He surveys the remainder a second and says, "Gents, if ever the liquor for the camp is on Toothpick Johnson, it's now. But there's one last duty to perform touching deceased. It's evident he's about to ask me for drink. It's the motion he makes for his whiskey which I mistakes for gunplay. There are errors, and stacks up this Red Dog person wrong. Now that I understands, while I acknowledges my fallacies, the least I can do is respect deceased last wishes. I therefore," says Toothpick, raising the Red Dog party's flask, "complies with what, if I hadn't interrupted him, would have been his last request, and regretting I don't savvy sooner, I drinks to him." "No," concluded the old cattleman, "as I intimates it to go off, Toothpick don't stay long after that. No one talks of stringing him for what's a plain case of bad judgment and nothing more. But still, Wolfville takes a notion to get him, and don't want him round none, so he has to freight out." "You're all right, Toothpick, speaking general," says old man Enright, when him and Doc Peters and Jack Moore comes up on Toothpick to notify him it's the Strangler's idea he'd better pack his wagons and hit the trail. "But you don't hold your six-shooter in what Doc Pete's here calls abeyance. Without putting no strain on your character, you ain't sedentary enough, and that you all is a heap too soon besides. In view of what I states, and of you dropping this here Red Dog gent, not an ounce of iron on him at the time, well, we exonerates, we decides, without a dissentin' vote, to sort of look round the camp for you tomorrow, say at sundown, and hang you some, should you then be present year. That's how the herd is grazing, Toothpick, and if you're out to commit suicide, you'll be particular to be with us at the hour on names." And that was Toothpick Johnson's ostracism. And our last story is How the Dumb Man Rode. "Now, I don't reckon none," remarked the old cattleman with a confidential air, "this year dumb man incident ever rises to my mind again, if it ain't for a gent whose trail I cuts while I'm projectin' round the post office for letters. It's this morning, and I'm getting letters, as I states, when I catches this old party sort of beamin' on me frank and free, like he's sure a friendly Injun. At last he sanders over and remarks, 'Whatever is your callin', pard?' or some such bluff as that. I sees he's good people fast enough. Still, I allows a small, brief jolt maybe does higher good. 'Well,' I says, intendin' to let him know I'm alive and wakeful that-a-way, 'well, whatever my callin' is, at least it ain't been no part of my bringin' up to let mere strangers stroll into the corral and cinch a saddle onto me for a conversational canter just because they're dispositioned that-a-way. No offense meant,' says the old party, as I observes he grows red and ashamed plumb up to his white hair. 'Excuse me, amigo,' I says, handin' out my paw, which he seizes all radiant and soon, 'I ain't intended nothin' blunt, nor to slam no door on better acquaintance, but when you all ropes at me about what you refers to as my callin' that time, I ain't just looking for a stranger to take such interest in me, and I'm startled into being unpolite. I'll therefore tenders regrets, and, startin' all over, states without reserve that I'm a cowman. And now,' I retorts further, merely to play my hand out, 'and not that I looks to take a trick at all, let me ask what pursuits do you pint out as a pretext for livin'?' 'Me?' says the old party, stabbin' at his shirt bosom with his thumb. 'Me? I'm a scientist.' 'Which the news is exhilaratin' and interestin'. I says, 'Shake again. If there's one thin I regards high, it's a scientist. Whatever particular wagon track do y'all follow off, may I ask?' It's then this old gent and I lanches into a general discussion under the head of miscellaneous business, I reckons, and Lye puts it up his long suit, and he calls it his moral epidemics. He says he's wrote one book onto 'em, and swears he'll write another if nobody heads him off, the same being unlikely. As he now sees I'm interested, the old sport sets down, lays it out to me how sentiments goes in herds and droves, same as weather and things like that. One day you rolls out in the morning, this old gent declares, and there you reads how everybody commits suicide. Then some other day it's murder, then robbery, and again, the whole roundup goes to holding them church meetings and getting religion. Them's waves, moral epidemics, he says. Which, this don't look so egregious none as a statement, neither. And so after powwowing a lot, all complacent and genial, I tells the old gent he's got a good game, and I thinks myself his system has pints. At this, he admits he's flattered. And then, as we're getting to the ends of our lariats, we tips our sombreros to each other and lets it go at that. Tomorrow he's going to confer on me his book, which I means to read it, and then I'll savvy more about his little play. But, continued my friend, warm with his new philosophy, this year is all preliminary, and brings me back to what I remarks at the jump, that what that old gent urges recalls this dumb and deaf man incident, which it sort of backs his play. It's a time when a passel of us gets overcome by waves of sentiment that-a-way, and not only turns a hoss thief loose entire after the felon's done been run down, but Boggs waxes that sloppy, he lavishes a hoss and saddle onto him, likewise sympathy, and wishes him luck. The whole racket's that unnatural, I never does quit wondering about it. But now this old science sharp expounds his theory of moral epidemics, it gets cleared up in my mind, and I reckons, as he says, it's surely one of them waves. Tell the story? Well, there's nothing much to said yarn, only the unprecedented leniency wherewith we winds it up. In the first place, I don't know what this hoss thief's name is, for he's plumb deaf and dumb, and ain't saying a word. I sees him hovering around, but I don't say nothing to him. Observes him once or twice write things to folks he has to talk with on a piece of paper, but it's too slow a racket for me. Too much like conversing by freight that-a-way, and I declines to stand in on it. I don't like to write well enough to go opening a correspondence with strangers who's deaf and dumb. When he first dawns on the camp, he has money, moderate at least, and he gets in on poker and stud and other devices which is open and common, and gents who's with him at the time say he has a level notion of hands, and, in the long run, maybe, amasses a little wealth. Well, I ain't paying much heed to him. I do hear towards the last of his stay is how he goes broke against Faro Bank. But as gents often goes broke against Faro Bank, and as, in truth, I taste such reverses once or twice myself, the information don't excite me none at the time, nor later on. It's mighty likely some little space since this dumb person hits camp. And there's an outfit of us rambling round in the red light, which, so to speak, is the Wolfville Club, and killing time by talking. Dave Tutt and Texas Thompson is holding forth at each other on the efficacy of prayer, and the balance of us is being edified. It looks like Texas has been telling of a Mexican feller that he sees lynched at Laredo one time, and how a tender gent rings in some more risins before ever they swings him off. Texas objects to them prayers and brands them as hypocrisies. As frequent happens, for both is powerful debaters that-a-way, Dave Tutt locks horns with Texas, and they both prances round oratorical at each other mighty entertaining. Now you gents understand, says Texas Thompson, I ain't saying a word about them prayers as mere speculations. I'm here to state it regards them as excellent, and there's gents at that time present who's experts in such appeals, and who knows what praying is, who allows that for fervency, bottom, and speed, they surely makes the record for what you might call offhand prayers in southern Texas. There ain't a preacher short of Waco or Dallas who could have turned a smoother trick, but what I complains of is, it's inconsistent. However's praying that-a-way unconsistent, I'd surely like to know, says Tutt, stacking in again Texas plenty scornful. "Why, this-a-way," says Texas. "Here's a gent who assembles with his peers to hang a Mexican feller. As a first flashing out of the box, he puts up a strong prayer talk to get this criminal by the heavenly gate. Now, whatever do you reckon a saint who knows his business is going to say to that? Here stands this conceited Laredo party recommended for admission on high, a Mexican feller he's pining to lynch for high crimes. If them powers above ain't allowing that praying party's got his nerve with him, they ain't giving the case the study which is sure it's due." "Which I don't know," says Tut. "I don't accept them views nohow. Praying's like going blind in poker. All you do is hope a lot. If the angels take stock in your applications, well and good. If they don't, you can gamble away your spurs. They're plenty able to protect themselves. All you can do is file them supplications. The angels lets them go or turns them down accordin'. Now, I holds that this Laredo sport who prays that time does right. There's nothing like a showdown, and his play, since he volunteers to ride herd on the Mexican feller's soul, is to win out if he can." "That's whatever," says Dan Boggs, who's listening full of interest, and who allows he'll butt in on the talk. "I jines with Tut on this. My notion is, when it comes a gent's turn to pray, let him pray, and not go pestering him hisself with vain surmises as to how it's going to strike them hosts on high. You can wager you ain't going to ride round omnipotence none. You can draw up to the layout of life, and from the cradle to the grave, you'll not pick up no sleepers on Providence that-a-way. Now, once, when I overcrossed the Mogollon Plateau, I..." But we never does hear what happens to Boggs that time over across the Mogollon Plateau. For when he's that far along, one of the hands from the corral comes scurrying up and asks Texas Thompson, does he lend his pinto pony an hour back to the party who's deaf and dumb? "Which I surely don't," says Texas. "You don't aim to tell me none he's done got away with my pinto hoss." The stable feller announces that maybe an hour before, this party comes over to the corral, makes a motion or two with his hands, cinches the hull onto the pinto, and lines out for the northeast on the Silver City Trail. He's been plumb out in sight for more than half an hour. "Which I likes that," says Texas Thompson, "for broad, open-air, noonday hoss-stealing. I offers even money this dumb gent's enterprise is entitled to the red ticket, which we ain't standing there talking long. If there's one reform to which the entire West devotes itself, it's breaking people this habit of horse-stealing. It ain't no time when four of us is off on the dumb party's trail, and half of that is consumed in taking a drink. Why ever be gents in the West so sought again horse-thieves? Son, you abides in a region at once populous and fertile, but if you was put in 3 months on a cactus desert, with water holes 50 miles apart, it'd begin to glimmer on you as to what it means to find yourself afoot. It would come over you like a landslide that the party you steals your hoss would have improved your condition in life a heap if he'd played his hand out by shooting a hole through your heart. No, I ain't in no such hurry to hang people for standing in on some killing. There's two sides to a killing, and if deceased is framed up with a gun, all regular all the time, he goes a long way toward exculpating of the sport who outlives him. But there ain't only one side to hoss-stealing, and the sooner the party's strung up or plugged, the sooner there's a victory for the right. As I remarks, it ain't 2 minutes when there's four of us gone swarming off after the dumb man who's got Texas Thompson's pinto pony. From the tracks, he ain't making no play to throw us off, for he maintains a straightaway run down the Silver City Trail and never leaves it or doubles once. Running of the dumb man down don't turn out no arduous task. It's due mainly, however, because the pinto sticks a cactus thorn in its hoof and goes lame in less time thereafter than it takes to turn a jack. "Hands up," says Texas, getting the drop as he swings up on the deaf and dumb fugitive. But there's no need of such precautions, as the dumb party ain't packing no weapons, not so much as a knife. There's nothing to say, no talk to make, when we takes him. Texas hefts him out in the saddle and ropes his elbows behind with a lariat. "What do you all suggest, gents?" says Texas. "I suppose now the decorous way is to go on with this year aggressive and energetic person to them pinion trees ahead and hang him some." "Which there's no doubts floating in anybody's mind on that subject," says Dan Boggs. "But I'd sure admire to know who this party is and where he's heading to. I dislikes to stretch the neck of strangers that-a-way. If there's any gent now who can ask this year person who he is and what he's got to say, I'd take it as a favor personal if he'd begin making of the needed motions. But there ain't none of us can institute them gestures, and when the dumb man, on his side, puts up a few bluffs with his fingers, it's a heap too complicated for us as a means of making statements." "I sure couldn't tell," says Dave Tutt, as he sits watching the dumb man's play, "whether he's calling us names or asking for whiskey." "Which, if we'd thought to bring some stationery," says Texas, "after we all go through our war bags in vain, we might open some successful negotiations with this person. As 'tis, however, we're plumb up against it, and I reckon, Boggs, he'll have to hang without you and him being formally introduced." "Just the same, I wishes," says Dave Tutt, "the Doc Peets or Enright was along. They'd sure dig something out in this citizen." "Maybe he's got papers in his wamas," says Boggs, "which unfolds concerning him. Go through 'em, Texas, anyhow." All Texas can find on the dumb man is one letter. The postmark, when we comes to decipher the same, shows he only gets it that morning. Besides, this year's single missive that-a-way, there ain't a scrap of nothing else to him, nor yet no wealth. "Tell us what's in the letter," says Texas, turning the document over to Boggs. "Read her out, Dan. I'd play the hand, but I has to ride herd on the culprit." "I can't read it," says Boggs, handing the note to Tutt. "I can't read readin', let alone writin'. But I'm free to say, even without hearing that document none, that I surely hesitates to string this party up. Being tongueless and not hearing a lick more natters, somehow he keeps appealing to me like he's locoed." "Which, if you ever has the pleasure to play some poker with him," says Tutt as he unfolds the paper, "like I do 3 nights ago, you wouldn't be annoying yourself about his being locoed. I finds him plenty deep and wary, not to say plumb crafty. Another thing, it's plain he not only gets letters, but we all sees him right about his drinks to blackjack, the red light barkeep, and similar plays." By this time, Tut's got the letter open and is getting ready to read. The dumb man's been standing there all the time, with his arms roped behind him, and looking like hope has died, and also like he ain't caring much about it neither. When Tutt turns open the letter, I notices the tears kind of start in his eyes, same as if he's some affected sentimental. "Which this year communication is plenty brief," says Tutt, as he runs his eye over it. She's dated Casa Grande, and reads as follows to wit. "Dear Ben, Myra is dying. Come at once. A." "Now, whoever do you reckon this year Myra is?" asked Tutt, looking around. "She's cashing in, that's obvious. And I'm putting it up she's mighty likely a wife or something of this year dumb party." "That's it," says Boggs. "He gets this word that Myra's gone over the big divide, and being he's gone broke entire on Faro Bank, he plunges over to the corral and rustles Thompson's horse. Under such circumstances, I ain't none sure he's responsible. I take it there ain't much doubt but Myra's his wife that-a-way, in which event my idea is he only borrows Thompson's pinno. Which, naturally, as I freely concedes, this last depends on Myra being his wife." "Oh, not necessarily," says Texas Thompson. "Thar's a heap of wives who don't justify hoss stealing a little bit. Now, I plays it open. Myra's this dumb gent's mother, and on such a theory and that alone, I removes the lariat from his arms and throws him loose. But don't try to run no wife bluff on me. I've been through the wife question with a blazing pine knot in my hand, and there's nothing worthwhile concealing therein." "Which I adopts the ain't endear assent," says Boggs, "and on second thought, I strings my chips with Texas, that this here Myra's his mother. I got the money that says so. At any rate, says Tut, from all I sees, I reckons it's the general notion that we calls this thing a draw. We can't afford to go making a precedent of hanging a gent for hoss-stealing who's only doing his best to be present at this here Myra's funeral, whoever she may be. It's a heap disgusting, however, that we can't open up a talk with this party, which I now notes by the address his name is McIntyre. And so, it turns out that in no time, from four gents who's dead set to hang this dumb man as a hoss-thief, we turns into a sympathetic outfit, which is digging holes for his escape. It all dovetails in what my scientist calls this morning about them moral epidemics and things going that away in waves. For after all, Myra, or no Myra, this here dumb man steals that pintle horse. However, whether it's right or wrong, we turns the dumb man free. Not only that, but Boggs gets out of the saddle and gives him his pony to pursue them rambles with. I gives it to him because it's the best pony in the outfit, says Boggs, looking savage at us as he puts the bridle in the dumb gent's hands. It can run like an antelope, that pony can, and that's why I donate it to this here dumb party. Once he's started, even if we all changes our moods, he's sure and safe away for good. Moreover, a gent whose mother's dying can't have too good a hoss. If he don't step on no more cactus and half rides, he's due to go charging into Casa Grande before they loses Myra easy. And that was How the Dumb Man Rode, from Wolfville Days by Alfred Henry Lewis. Thank you for joining us again for Western Short Stories. This has been Dan Klingler, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.
An old cowboy went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a plowing through the ragged sky, and up the cloud he draw. Aye, yippee-i-ho.
If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org, left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then, under Programming Links, left click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device as well.